And I'm Reggie.
And this
is Army Talks.
Army Talks.
Hello, Brian.
Hello, Reggie. How are you this fine day?
Peachy. Feeling good, man.
Good. I feel pretty good myself.
I'm lying.
I'm old. I don't feel bad. I'm just old.
Mr. Half a Century.
Half a century. Turned 50. Half a century. I turned 50. I went in the bathroom, and I tooted, and dust came out.
But your balls didn't hit the water, dude.
That happens to me more often than you would think. Honestly.
It's the worst, dude.
It's the worst, man. Especially if you're sleepy and tired in the morning and the water's cold, dude. And you're not expecting it.
I'm just thankful my toilets here at the house doesn't. That you don't do that.
Dude, I'm thankful that I've never done it in a porta potty.
Well, most of the time there's no water there.
Well, first of all, going to a porta potty I would rather crap myself, honestly, than go to a porta potty because that's the grossest thing on the planet.
It's very gross.
People just do vile and abhorrent things in porta potties, and I don't want to be a part of that. Somebody asked me a question the other day. And I thought about it and I gave an answer and I don't know if it's the right answer. Somebody said, Brian, you're 50. Do you feel like you have 50 years of wisdom? And I was like, no. And they were like, why? I was like, because there's no wisdom between the ages of 1 and 10. you're just falling out of trees and eating Oreos and trying not to go to bed when you're supposed to and doing all that. There's no wisdom there. I said, and from the time you're like 11 to 18, your hormones have kicked in and all you want to do is get with girls and do stupid stuff and hang out with your friends. It's like, I might have 30 years of wisdom, but as far as 50 goes,
it's tough.
No,
yeah,
not 50.
Yeah, no, man. I wouldn't say no. No, I didn't start to be even close to wise until at least 25. Even close. Yeah.
I think my wisdom started the moment I realized that the world was not going to be the Easter egg full of treasure I thought it would be.
Yeah, I just think there's that attitude though, right? That you're the entitlement.
Yeah.
Something I think there's a few kids that, you know, they have a pretty rough way to go and they see the world a little different.
Yeah.
But you know, It's interesting in America, man. I mean, it's
totally. I'm just, I think part of, and I'm kind of grateful for it, is I had a rough upbringing. And because of that, I never had a sense of entitlement. And I had to, and it did affect me in negative ways in my 20s, some in my early 30s, but it actually worked in my favor because it made me very streetwise, and it also made me it gave me great discernment to know when I'm being BS'd and when somebody's being for real, and all those things have come in handy. And they're traits I'm teaching my kids, but I'm not like trying to be like, go out and do all the horrifically dumb stuff your dad did. But I'm like, go out and, you know, if somebody, my number one advice I give my kids is I say, don't listen to what they say, watch what they do. Somebody can say anything and do anything, but you need to watch what they do.
Well, you need to observe.
Yeah.
Be an observer.
Yeah.
And a careful observer.
Yeah. A lot of times I will be the most important quiet guy in the room because I'm just watching what's going on.
I mean, right? The thing is, I wasn't like that for a long time. I was a real big ham when I was a kid and teenager. I just wanted to be the center of attention all the time and all this kind of stuff. And until in my 20s and stuff when I finally settled down and I thought, you know what, this isn't really the right way to go. Then I turned into that guy that kind of just stands in the back and I just watch.
I'm friendly. I'll talk to you.
But it pays off though too when you get to situations where you don't exactly know what's the proper, what they're expecting. Like for instance, the first time you go to like a private club dinner kind of thing where it's all this formal stuff with you got all these different courses and everything. The first time you do that as an adult, if you've never done it before, which was me, like it was real important that I just kind of, I'm just going to sit here.
Yeah.
And we're just going to see what happens. And then
we're going to move when they move.
Yeah. And then we'll see what fork they use and what.
I got really lucky because in high school I had a good friend. Her name was Angie. And, Angie's dad was in local politics. I think he was like a councilman and he owned a business and he would go to these dinners and Angie would invite me and we were friends. We never dated. It wasn't that kind of thing.
I got you.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So I kind of learned because she would teach me, like I'd go to these white tablecloth dinners at these golf clubs and there'd be like three forks and four spoons. And I'm like at home, we just have a shovel. Like, and she'd be like, this is for your, you know, this fork is for your salad. This fork is for your main course. The spoon is for your soup. The spoon is for your dessert. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Well, y'all are just whooping it up, aren't you?
Well, but, you know, too, like, and then you get into a different culture thing, like where like if you, in my travels and stuff, I've had the opportunity to like have dinner with all kinds of different people.
Yep.
Right. And yep. Some of them even at their home, like, you know, they'd be like, hey, my wife is cooking dinner. You want to cook? And that was really the best, dude. Because it was like, this is, then you're really communicating and it's really there. So it's really one of those things where it just helps so much if you just take a step back, uh-huh. You know, just make sure you're not offended. And you ask, I mean, it was like being honest. It's like, hey, I remember, were they Pakistani or were they? Oh, I can't remember now, man. So many of them. There was just one time and I was like, hey, I don't want to offend anybody. So what are we doing? How do I do this? You know, it was like, oh, that's right. You know,
you've never done this.
And then it became a thing, you know, they're like, oh, silly American, you know?
Yeah. I went to a dinner with two guys that I worked with that were African and, went to their apartment and they had like a formal dinner and everybody sat around this little table and you had to like fold your food up. You had to pick your food up with the bread and you're supposed to eat with your right hand and you're supposed to drink with your left hand. And
oh yeah, there's all kinds of things.
You had to finish chewing before you wiped your hands and things like that. And like, it was just weird because I had one of those guys on my right side and he was coaching me. He was like, all right. He's like, cause I told him, I was like, I don't know what is going on in here.
Well, yeah, like you know, I had a friend of mine who was Korean when I was growing up, and you know that was different.
Yeah,
I've never been to Japan, yeah. But that's different too. You know, they have some things that are faux pas, and you know, anyway, it was really, but yeah, being the learning to like step back and just observe and quiet, yeah. You know, be a little more quiet is really important as you get older, especially the stoicism mindset kind of thing that kind of goes along with it.
Well, people don't realize that stoicism is a great tool, right? Like it helps you. It being a stoic person helps you observe. And don't get me wrong, I love a good joke and a good laugh.
Well, it's like be so self-confident you don't feel like you have to prove anything.
Yeah.
Or not be afraid to be wrong or not be it's like you're not worried about being the smartest guy in the room or being the most, you know, knowledgeable thing or, you know, whatever. You're just there. Right. I mean, that's really what you're trying to do and experience it.
What was it that Arnold Schwarzenegger said? Exist in the room like you belong there. Yep. He said, that doesn't mean you're talking. He says, just be confident enough to be there.
Yeah. I mean, right? It's like a chill way to go about it, man. Like you're just laid back about stuff. But anyway.
Yeah.
So anyway. Well, so what did you do anything good for your birthday, by the way?
I ate a taco.
You ate a taco.
And I went to bed. We're doing stuff for my birthday this weekend. But anyway, doctor, 100% cleared.
Look at you.
20/20 vision. Everything's good. He said, and I didn't know this, but he took this caliper and he put it on my face and he measured the depth of my eyeballs. And he's like, normally when that happens, one of the eyes is 3 or 4 millimeters off and backwards. He goes, yours are perfect at 18 on both sides.
Well,
he's like,
it's,
but I was like, first of all, that says something about him as a surgeon, right? To go in and rebuild me like that. And then to do the things that he did.
You gotta be detail oriented.
Yeah. And then the healing process, because I mean, I say this a lot, but I mean it. When he told me, in the consultation before the surgery, he goes, Brian, I don't know how you manage not to lose either a good portion of your vision or that eye. He goes, because 9 out of 10 of these surgeries that I do, our conversation is this is how much of your vision you're going to lose, or do you want to leave the eye in, or do we just take it? Like the type of blowout that I had normally results in massive optical nerve damage and massive damage to the blood flow in the eyeball. And I had none. Like, he goes, even in the best case scenario I've had, he goes, nobody's walked out at 20/20.
Well, you're the one.
And I was like, thank okay. you, God. I was Let's like, go. Thank you, Lord. you know, good on you.
Yeah, my other Lord. Friend, he's still having some issues, man. He's going through it. But so I am officially going to be a real lumberjack next week.
I know you're going to cut down like 22 trees.
No. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun.
Dude, are you going to wear like a checkered flannel?
It's too hot for a freaking flannel,
man. Hey, you're a lumberjack.
No.
You have to wear a checkered flannel.
No, I don't.
And really blue jeans, like the ones that are super blue.
Super blue.
And then you have to wear Wolverine boots.
Nah, man. I mean, I don't know if like, I don't know what PPE is necessary on the job. You know, I don't, because technically, like if you're doing that, you gotta have steel toe boots. You gotta wear your, either chainsaw pants or chaps, or, you have to wear long sleeves, have a face shield, have a hard hat, ear protection, all this stuff. I don't know how far one of these, this gig goes, if it goes anywhere at all. So I have all that. It's just a matter
so
of.
So you may be a temporary lumberjack is what you're saying.
Well, it is a very temporary lumberjack. I'm just helping a buddy out for one project here, and that's it, you know? So.
Well, you know.
But you know what? It was fascinating is how much things cost. Like if you think about, you know, so my big saw that I have that used for felling and stuff is about, it cost $1,500, right? And then it uses, you know, the one chain for that. One chainsaw chain is like $30.
All right. So, dude, I'm going to make a confession right now. All of my yard equipment combined are probably not worth $1,500.
No, I hear you. It's just, but it's one of those things where I like to do. So I bought a nice one.
Yeah.
Big thing. Now, granted, it's huge and it's heavy and it's, you know, so do you really need it? No, but I just wanted it anyway. The point being, you know, bar, the super bar I got was like $200, right, for the thing. Yeah. And then like you got the, you know, 1 gallon of the 50-to-1 fuel that's non-ethanol or whatever. If you buy it from the store, it's like $25, you know, for a gallon of that, or you go to find a place that doesn't have, anyway, the whole point is like you're spending, not counting the equipment, you know, or the chain costs or whatever, you've got a couple hundred dollars worth of stuff you're going to use during that kind of thing, you know, just in oil and gas and, you know, stupid stuff. It's crazy, man. And then, you know, there's a, When somebody says, well, I want this tree cut down. You're just like, well, it's $1,500. Well, the reason why it's $1,500 because, you know, the chainsaws, the chains on there, the bars, the gas, the oil, the all this. It's just it's expensive, man.
I'll be honest with you, man. I took on a tree job one time. Me and Caleb, we took on a tree job. We went to this dude's house, and the tree had already fallen down. It was after a storm. And he's like, I need you to cut this up and haul the wood off. So I quoted him $400. $400 for us to chop it up and haul it off. I should have quoted him $1,000. I went through 3 gallons of fuel. Mm. I broke a chainsaw chain and had to replace it while on the job. I had to replace it while I was on the job. Luckily, I had a spare in the truck. And we were there for 5.5 hours. And we both walked away with $200 in our pocket, and I felt like I got robbed. But I didn't know what I was doing, right? So I have a lot of respect for guys who are out there doing like heavy labor. Like that's some heavy stuff. Like we chopped that tree up into pieces, and there were some of those logs that we had to both grab hold of to throw into the back of the truck, right? So it was, But the guy was super nice, and I think he gave us like a bonus $100 or something, because he was like, he goes, you guys are the two hardest working dudes I've ever seen. And I'm like, trust me, I want to make you eat that check right now and then demand more, but I'm not going to, because I'm the one that bid the job at this suck price.
But you know what's funny is too, like that kind of stuff, you're only talking about labor and time to do it, really. If you look at tougher jobs where, like, if you need a crane,
yeah,
or somebody's got to like start rigging up stuff,
yeah, that's expensive.
Or you need an excavator is going to be, you know, used or something, dude. That stuff is crazy. Like the
it's ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you got a minimum. It's easily gets $5,000-$6,000
just
for the crane alone at a minimum, right?
Yeah.
And it's crazy, man, how that stuff gets real expensive. So
that's when you like go out and get some yard rope and start winching people up into trees. And
well, that's the thing too. Even though, like, if you talk about rope, dude, so the rope you need, if you're going to do any rigging, is like static. Like it's, you know, it's meant for that. You can't just go pick some, oh, here's this rope. It's you will hurt somebody. You will hurt something.
I watched a video of a guy felling a tree the other day, and he fell the tree right through the middle of somebody's house. And when I say through the middle, I mean, it went through the second floor, right into the first floor.
Oh yeah. It's crazy.
And I think they said at the end of the video, there was like $61,000 worth of damage that was done, and the guy didn't have insurance. So basically he was on the hook for 100% of it. Like, dude.
Yeah, you just screwed up. But it's just like, you know, you have to really understand like a lot of stuff.
Physics.
Dude. I mean.
Like physics for felling a tree. I mean, you got to understand that it's not just cutting it at an angle where it falls away. You have to make sure that the tree is not weighted heavy to the backside of where you're cutting the angle. And you got, there's all these different like calculations you got to put in there to make sure that you don't like.
I don't do this for a living either, man.
Yeah.
But I have a couple $1,000 worth of rigging stuff. That's how much it costs. And that's just like, I have like two ropes that I can use for rigging and pulling like, or whatever. I have like some pulleys and some anchors and not even that much.
I got to say, Reggie, you are my friend and I trust you, but I'm not letting you rig me to anything and cut a tree down.
Rig you to anything? I'm not rigging you.
If you're like, hey, dude, I'm going to rig you up and pull you up there. And you just like,
oh, no.
It's like, nope.
I would, now look, here's the thing, man. I would climb the trees if they made, they don't make this. Well, you can have it made. They can make it. They can, the tree spikes aren't a problem, but like the harnesses and stuff, they don't really make those off the shelf for a big guy like me. You have to have them made, and there are companies that'll do that. But dude, those are
expensive.
Oh man, it's crazy expensive, right? So it's like if you're not doing that for a living, it's not happening. Yeah. You know. Yeah. But I will say this for anybody who's like, oh, I'll just get up there with this and then that. No,
you won't.
The thing is,
be stupid.
Well, the thing is, it's the most dangerous thing you can do on your farm or whatever, on your place, is cut down a tree. It's the most dangerous thing you can do, pretty much.
I always thought the most dangerous thing you could do is slap a bull.
If you don't have bulls, I guess. Don't slap a bull.
Yeah, don't slap a bull. I feel like that's immediate danger. You have at least 2 to 4 minutes whilst preparing to cut down a tree to maybe rethink the fact that you're trying to cut down a tree. But if I slap a bull, I don't think the bull's going to wait to react.
I just think that you're slapping a bull and you probably deserve whatever you get.
That's true.
It's like
I got to say this. One of my favorite things that I do every day, and I spend about 10 minutes doing it, is I watch videos of dudes doing stupid stuff. Mainly guys get hit in the nuts, which is hilarious because they get hit in the nuts. They deserve it. Like there's one video. It's my favorite. There's this big, heavy-set Asian dude, and he's got his foot up. He's like Captain Morgan on this rail, and he's hitting it with a hammer, and he takes his eyes away and literally just swings and busts himself right in the giblets. And I'm like, you deserve that. Because you, first of all, don't take your eye off the prize, no matter what. And secondly, Why you got a Captain Morgan while you're hitting something, man? Like you're, it's like, and he cries, like you can literally see tears. And I'm like, dude, go get checked out. But you deserve that. Like I watched disastrous things. Like I watched a guy, he thought it would be a good idea to put nitrous on his motorcycle.
They do that, by the way. No,
but I'm talking like a Kawasaki dirt bike. And he got going and he kicked the nitrous in and the bike exploded and launched him off of it. And I think he broke everything. I think he Evel Knievel'd it. Like I really do.
That's brutal.
And I think to myself, at what point in your day did you go, you know what would be awesome? I put a bottle of nitrous on my 1971 Kawasaki motorbike that I've owned since I was nine, and try to go really fast in the street.
It's funny.
But anyway, but like, okay, so today, what are we talking about, Reggie? Lay it on me. I came up with the subject, but I want to hear you introduce it. Say it.
We will discuss why and the ins and outs of importance of God creating the different races and creeds and stuff.
Okay. So, I'll let you begin. If you were to give somebody, and this is just the beginning, but if you were to give somebody like the 30,000 foot view of why and how God culturally exists between different races and creeds, what would you say?
Okay, how he exists between the different races and creeds, I would say he doesn't exist any different between anybody.
Well, but I mean, the better question is, how does he present? Like, I'll give you an example. You got your average everyday Baptist, right? And over here you got your Russian Orthodox Jew.
Okay.
And both of them believe in God, right?
Okay, but you got an Orthodox Jew who doesn't believe in Jesus.
But what I'm saying is God. Believing in God in the general sense of having a savior, having a higher power.
Okay.
How does, you know, contextually with traditions, how is it that God translates between like the Baptist and the Orthodox Jew and the Presbyterian down the road? And because this is a big thing for me. This is why I've gone non-denominational, because I'm so worn out with all of it. But how do we translate the existence of God with all these different traditions and all these different things? How does he present amongst all those in a way where the translation's clear to everyone? Does that make sense? Or am I just over here just talking like a crazy person?
I would just say that the whole thing where God is unchanging. He's the same today as he was yesterday, as he was 1,000 years ago, whatever. The same God that was in the Babylonian times is the same God who lives today.
Yeah.
Right?
Christ, God is never changing.
Yeah. So the whole point of those denominations and everything, are they're trying to get as close to the truth of who God is that they can.
Yeah.
Right? So this Orthodox Jew is going to think whatever they think God is.
Yeah.
And they have their reasons for looking at God the way they do. And then their Baptist, like you mentioned, has their truth about who God is. But only one of them is going to be the truth. Objective truth the objective ultimate truth of God is the thing that is the quest of should be everyone's quest to really understand the God, to the truth, his ultimate reality that you exist in, right?
Yeah.
So how that translates, it's different because they're following or not understanding or missing a piece of the puzzle or whatever. Because it's impossible for a human being to fully understand God and it's in his entirety because he's infinite.
Mm-hmm.
We only get so much, enough to know what and who he is and what we're supposed to be. And that's different between the different religions and everything else.
Okay.
But there's only one objective truth, reality that God is. That's it. So when you say translates between these two things, they're looking at different teachings between, like, again, Orthodox Jew versus Baptist. I mean, you're talking about two completely, well, I shouldn't say completely. There's a half of a canon of scripture that the Orthodox Jew will kind of look at the same as a Christian.
Yeah.
Except there's
half of it that he won't.
Except, yeah, they leave out the whole Jesus thing
in New Testament, and basically.
Just, yeah, they don't believe any of that.
Well, here's another question. Like, and this has borne so many questions as I've studied this, man. I'm trying to think of a way to say this where it doesn't sound okay. So I'll use an example that's in the news now. The Catholics have a new pope, right? And this new pope seems to be much more traditional. Right. If you listen to he came out and he talked about how marriage is between a man and a woman. That's sacred. He said all these things. And the old pope.
Quite a bit different.
Was very liberal.
Even said there was more than one way to God.
Yeah. If God is never changing. And the body of the Catholic Church is where it's at. Right. And this is not about Catholic right or wrong. This is just a question, right? This is just a way of looking at this.
Okay.
If God is ever changing, then how can one pope be right and one pope be wrong? Discuss.
Human.
But not according to Catholics.
Well, the Catholics are wrong.
But that's not the point. All right. I don't want to go off on the whole gag about how you feel about Catholics.
I know.
What I'm saying is, like, do you think that that's going to cause dissension between, obviously, the Pope that's passed had a different set of traditions, right, that he wanted to impart into the church.
Yeah.
A lot of them were not, even on his best day, weren't biblical. This new Pope is like, whoa, 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 let's pull back the reins. We got out of control. You know, let's get back to traditional Catholic beliefs. Do you think that's going to cause a schism within the Catholic Church?
Anytime a leader of a Christian body decides to pull back to what the scripture says, is, I don't care if it's a schism or not, it's a good thing.
I know, but what I'm saying is, again, here we do, now we have two, within one section of one quote unquote people of God, we now have
two different divisions. Yeah. Well,
right.
Keep in mind, though, this whole thing about, I think this equates to how bonkers this whole thing is with the Pope and the Catholic Church and everything else. Anyway.
Yeah, but still.
But all I'm saying is that, you know, you had they appoint this. They appointed the last one.
Yeah.
And they put him up there. And he's supposed to be this ultimate, you know, one direct connection to God kind of thing or whatever, and got a lot of it wrong.
Well, here's my next question, you know, and this goes to, like, divine mandates. Like, what am I saying? if the divine mandate is the choice, right? They're choosing a pope. I'm not picking on the Catholics, but how is it a divine mandate if it took four or five votes to figure out who they were going to be, who's going to be the
pope? But see, man, I mean, this is where we're,
you see what I'm saying?
I'm not going to have anything to input here, really, because I don't believe any of this is legitimate.
But okay, better way to say it. All right, so in Timothy, it talks about elders and deacons, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I know that there are some churches where elders and deacons are voted for in private, they're voted for and chosen by other elders and deacons.
Okay.
Okay. I know some churches that are, it's public to the church. The church comes out and votes yay or nay. Right. But being that there's so many differences and separations in tradition and in geography. I mean, if you talk to Baptists in the North and the South and the East and the West, there's tons of different traditions between those churches. Yeah. My question is this, and I guess this is the searcher in me, right? Because ever since I've gone non-denominational, I've kind of stood back and I've looked at the way the other churches are behaving. And I think to myself, if we're ever going to unite under one God, you guys are going to have to chill out. You're going to have to accept that this church wears suits, this church doesn't, this church wears this, this church is a old earther, this church is a new earther. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter as long as we're all following the book.
But that, okay.
And what I find in this is the big thing that I'm trying to figure out here is amongst cultures. We talked about this a little bit earlier. I won't go that extreme. I realize that example I gave you was kind of extreme. But I think I know Baptist churches that have feuded with other Baptist churches over how you dress when you go to church.
But I think that's getting a little, okay, because there are superficial things that are different between different ways of seeing it that are you can argue over, and there's really not a quote unquote sinful or right. It's just a matter of preference.
Okay? Yes.
There are things like that, right? That are just preferential more than doctrinal.
Yeah.
Okay.
But isn't, okay. So doctrinally, by all definitions, what I believe is God and what I believe is Jesus and the Trinity is the same thing that the Presbyterian down the street believes is the Trinity and God. Why is it that there is this separation?
Well,
which gets a little bit more into what you're talking about with why God created the different tribes and the different things. I may think maybe that'll explain a little more, right?
Because I think different, because we're all unique.
Yeah, we're all created.
Every single human is a unique creation that he has knitted together in the womb, right? We all have unique purposes. We all have, it's, and even though there might be 99% of our lives that are similar to something else, but there's that 1% that's going to be whatever can be. I'm just saying that you throwing that out there just as an example, but there's something unique all of us have. Mm-hmm. These uniqueness of things help us actually be more in tune with the variations and the experiences that we can have in the reality in which we are existing in currently. Okay. Mm-hmm. So like, take for example, if you will better understand your own existence if you've experienced or seen or some another culture, right? Yeah. So even if that's like for me, when I started traveling a lot for work and stuff, like going to different places of the United States and then going to like the South America or like Canada or, you know, whether it be Europe or, you know, the Caribbean or Jamaica or whatever, right? You get to see these different ways people think and how they live and all this stuff, and it broadens your own mind about the universe you live in.
Yes,
like it grows from this little pocket of like, you know, podunk, you know, USA or something to like, wow, there's now you've been exposed to all these different things, and it makes you, for one, help you understand the vastness of like what he's done with the people and how different things can be. And also helps you better appreciate where you are and everything and where you're at and those kind of things. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and also too, you know, you got to understand, like, I look at it this way. And so when I looked at all this stuff, you know, like my, my first thought about like this stuff is like, God is not just one, he's one entity, but he's three individuals.
Yep.
Which is completely not a thing that we, that exists anywhere else except for in the Godhead.
Yeah.
The Trinity is unique, but it's still a diverse three individuals that are, serve one purpose.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So therefore, even in himself, he's diversified. You know, so like you got, that's the first place I kind of look at and go, okay, well that's, he's done that to fulfill the functions of what he wants to do and share and everything else that he's created in this whole reality that we live in. So it makes sense that we would have diversity and different things in this, in our world to help also fulfill kind of the mandates we have by him.
Okay.
So better understanding these different cultures, different creeds, different ways of living, the diversity between human beings, even it's between me and you, helps us better understand who he is.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
So when it gets into, in particularly when it gets into the little rifts and stuff that all these little denominations have, most of it is
garbage.
Silly. It's just silly.
Most garbage.
Now you do have though, and especially this has gone farther, the prosperity gospel infiltration into some of these larger organizations has created some heretical things that need to be
addressed. Sure. Some of the stuff I've heard is just, it just chills me to the bone
because it changes the way, it changes the gospel message, and that's the important thing. Like there's only one truth of God, Jesus, Holy Spirit, and how they are, and what.
Well, and let's get this out there too, because after we did our whole thing about prosperity gospel, one of the people that I know that listens had questions. It's not that God won't bless you to prosper. That's not the thing. Like God has different plans for all of us, right? And his plan might be for you to financially prosper, but to use that financial prosperity to better his kingdom, right? Different plans for different people. But when you start telling people, I don't think it's actually that they're changing the gospel. I think it's that they're distorting the truth behind it, right? The gospel, you or I, neither one have the ability to change the message of God. But I think what people do is it's like anything else. It's like when I used to hear old racist dudes say, "Be ye not unevenly yoked." Well, that's all cool and all, but you're not reading the whole verse, you ding dong. That's not what that means at all. That's not what God meant for that to be at all. You know, he meant for that to say, don't only count yourself amongst unbelievers, right? Because, you know, die down with dogs, you get fleas. So, that being said, you know, and prosperity gospel, man, after we got into that and started reading about that, that's been around forever.
A long time.
Like so long. But
it particularly ramped up
in the 80s.
Word of faith and all that stuff.
But anyway.
Anyway.
So you had some research about that. Give me some of your wisdom on that, that you've dug up on this.
Okay. So first off, where we see division of – Where we see diversity come to pass as far as cultures, creeds, and languages and all this stuff is really the Tower of Babel in Genesis.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the thing is, let me make this point clear though. It's debated. Let me say that. It's debated whether or not that comes from the lore of Babylonian or Mesopotamian lore or something like that, right? It's not as verifiable, maybe would be the way or whatever, but we consider that part of the canon and therefore it's important. Also, too, the where it's at is interesting because it's kind of stuck in the middle of a genealogy between of Noah's family and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not really, it doesn't occur in that timeline you would think, like it's one of those places in the Bible where actually that Tower of Babel stuff happens before Noah's family is going off and doing this and doing that.
Yeah.
it's really explaining why, how that came to be in another sense of it. Babel is interesting though. It's like, that's what it's saying is pretty much like, you know, man decided it was going to basically build a tower that was high enough to avoid any kind of flood again and get the, get to God and all, you know, yeah. It, really an egomaniacal trip. Yeah. Right. And the one thing that John Lennox was pointed out in his, when he was doing a talk about this at a conference, he was like, the funniest thing was when he kind of throws it out there was like, I have to come down to this, you know, it's like, God's even saying, like, you know, it doesn't matter how high you build that thing. I'm going to have to come down to it. It doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, you're never going to be able to do that. And that, and also too, the point being is that, you know, God's at a place we can't imagine at the moment. There's no reaching that. There's nothing like that. Our own hubris gets us in the way a lot. And we that's a thing to avoid. Yeah. Even now when we build these skyscrapers that are all there, there's a point of ego behind all that stuff and about reaching new heights and all this kind of stuff. But I digress. Anyway, the point being is that he said, you know, he was like, hey, we're going to diversify, you know, at that point, he's like, you all are united in one language and one people. Well, now that you've really shown your ego and you're trying to reach this new height, guess what? No, you're going to now be diversified and go about your own way and split up into cultures and languages and all this kind of stuff. That wasn't the only purpose, though. You have to look at this story too in the scope of the nation of Israel, because without that diversification and without that split up of thing, the nation of Israel would never have existed. So it's kind of points to there. And even when you see like Abram, who eventually becomes Abraham, in the text, you know, Shem is like his, you know, he like elevates Shem is, if you want to dig into it a little bit, but that's important because it's like now God says, hey, I will make you the father of a nation, yeah. Not you. I will do it.
Yes. You know? Yes.
So one of the key things there is like that also was a tool to push forward the narrative and what he wanted to happen for the nation of Israel. Cause no longer was it going to be all of humans that he was going to, you know, unite and everything else. Now he had a chosen people.
So do you think that had something to do with the 12 tribes? Indirectly, directly?
Not sure. Yeah, because it sets up the because without that, you wouldn't have the different tribes.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Right?
So, okay. Well, that makes sense. So talking about that, you know, if you go back through historically and you look through when Paul was traveling – and he would go to different places for worship and they would have they would have church. What they were really having was just a gathering, which really is what church is supposed to be, is a gathering of Christians living life as a family.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of different cultural differences there, but Paul never seemed to really get too deep into that unless it was crossing the line into being heretical. So when that is, Do you think that the early church kind of had it right? Like, yeah, we're all living in different regions. We're all worshiping God. You know, we might wear purple robes. This place might wear blue robes. The priests here might wear this, but we're all in the same place. Because I feel like the thing where we're losing our traction nowadays is, especially with the onset of like mega churches and things where people are getting a little too much power, a little too much influence. I think we've lost that ability to be like, they get it. We're there, but they get it. Like Elevation being an example. I think Furtick is way out of line on a lot of things. Heretical to me is being gentle, about some of the things that he said. You know, what I wonder is, did the early, and I guess you would call it the early church, did they have it right?
Well, sure. I mean, they started with, I mean, you got to think about like the apostles, man, were with Christ, man. I mean, like they were taught directly from Christ about what to do how to do things, who he was, what the, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? And so when they go out to search and disperse into these and send the, and fulfill that great commission and like set up the different churches and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that was so close. Yeah. I mean, and we only get a glimpse of like what that was, a kind of how that worked and everything in the New Testament. Cause it's, you know, there wasn't enough
time to track like in depth those things.
It spread, for one thing, it spread really rapidly. You were talking about a message that never before had been that rapid of a spread. And part of that's because Paul spent time in Rome.
Yeah.
And Rome was the center of the world at that moment. And, you know, and so, you know, that facilitated the whole spread of, of the message. But, you know, the thing here, I mean, yeah, the early church was working under this assumption, you know, right there after Christ had taught these disciples who went and built these churches. So yeah, they probably have it more right than we do. Let me preface that. I wouldn't say more right than we do. We know we weren't there, obviously, but the more time that goes on and the more we uncover about the ancient Greek language and the ancient Hebrew and all that stuff, and we're discovering more and more and more, it is helping us have a more and more better understanding and more fulfilled, I guess, message of like how all this stuff worked and everything else. So it's not, I would say they had it right. Yes. But we can also have it right too.
Well, and that kind of brings into my next question, you know, coming up, most of the men that I knew that were solid Christians, you remember them, the tough men of God, right? Where along the way in our kind of journey, I feel like it came with the onset of traveling evangelism. For me, back when you would see the tent evangelists first start popping up back in the 30s and 40s, really at a high rate, was where you started to see this sort of corruption of, well, we're not worried about tradition separation anymore. We all were okay. Now we're going to wear it. Now we have, you know, guys out here selling, you know, I read one about a guy who was out of the western part of the country and he was traveling in these tent revivals and he had these jars and he swore that it was the tears of Jesus. And if you just drink the tears of Jesus, all of your ailments will be wiped. All of your financial woes will go away, blah, 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 right? So where along the line do you think we kind of skewed away from being all on the same page and just with different traditions to it becoming more corrupted?
You had that, though, at the beginning of the church.
Yeah.
Right? That was going, I mean, Paul's letters are indicative of that.
Well, in Acts, the Jews that were going around trying to heal people in Jesus' name, right? And they had no clue.
No.
Right? But in our, I don't want to say our current culture, because Christianity's had been on a traveling path for 1,000 years. Where in our current culture do you think that really began to fall apart? And we began to do this thing where God, the church became a business, more or less to say.
Well, I mean, that's hard to say, man. I mean, because you got to understand, look at the nation that we have today. Where it came from, were the pilgrims from Europe who were seeking not just opportunity, but
to escape religious persecution.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, you have this whole thing about how America wasn't a Christian nation, even though it was like in all of the states' constitutions at the time where it said you had to believe, you had to be a believer, all this kind of thing. So, I mean, that's where the America started from, was there, right?
Yeah.
And I don't – keep in mind, though, you still have the Catholic Church, though, throughout history who's been – you can say it wasn't for profit, but look at them, look at what they did. I mean, yeah. I'm not saying it's all bad, but I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, they don't, you don't just build the Vatican, which is its own little nation stuck in
it's got nation status,
You know, and that didn't cost nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, so you've had churches that existed, you know, as a corporate entity for a long time. Maybe it wasn't like this, you know, modernized corporate entities we have today, but I think you've had that for, I mean, since the church has been around, man.
Yeah.
Now, what you're trying to get to is in our current reality we live in.
Yeah.
It takes money to exist and do things.
Yes.
Like, you know, if somebody wants to do church and they start a church and they have six people meet in a house, and that's where it starts from.
Yes.
Then it builds, and then all of a sudden you need a building. Well, now you got to fund the building somehow. Then you got to have staff, and then you got to do this. So it kind of, the way churches exist in the U.S., when you're talking about churches with buildings and everything else, there's a financial component to it. But you really have churches who do that well, and you have churches who don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have pastors who drive BMWs and Mercedes and stuff and that kind of thing. Actually don't begrudge that necessarily, because there's some, you know, some of these guys write books and sell things and they do speaking engagements and all this kind of stuff. And but I mean, you could say the part about a humble life is necessary, you know, but a lot of them though do it right, man. I mean, they try. But it's in the culture that we live in that it's America, bro. This is a different reality for a church organization than say in like Africa or, you know, or even in persecuted places like you have in China and North Korea and stuff like that, where churches aren't like that at all. Because if they are, they get killed, you know, it's immediate. Right. So, you know, in Europe, you have issues with this kind of thing, but you know, that in the current American United States of America climate,
yeah,
I think it's not a unique thing, but it's a more popular thing. If you look around the churches, like, cause we have we're in a Bible Belt here.
We're,
man,
a church rich country.
We have a church, well, church rich part of the country.
Well, yeah, I think in general as a country, we're very church rich in the sense that
we have a lot of churches,
of churches here.
Because we're really not persecuting it to the extent of like they do in the Middle East and some of the other countries.
Give them
a
couple of years.
But you know, if you go to like places like San Francisco or something like that, I mean, there's people who don't even, I mean, there's not churches around there. I mean, in some places. And matter of fact, I mean, because there's people that are going out there as missionaries. I mean, it's almost like that in some parts of the country now, right?
Yeah.
That they're like, well, we never really got into this. So we never had anybody here have a church. You know, that's different than what we have here in this part of the country.
Hard to believe that there are places in the United States that are underchurched.
Mm-hmm. I know, but there is, right? And that's that's an interesting thing,
yeah.
Right? But, and then you know, like Vadi Bakum, right? Who led that when he was doing his African stuff for years? You know, that was a totally different thing than what he was doing over here. And I don't remember the scope of that, but he's moving back here. I think doing something else. But like, example, I mean, you know, that guy is a prolific speaker.
He is, yes.
Travels all the time doing stuff, writing books, all this kind of stuff. I mean, you know, that's the reality we live in with pastors or leaders who are committed to, you know, teaching and spreading the gospel. But you have good and bad ones though.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. We have good and bad ones all the time. Okay. So kind of furthering the discussion, something that, you know, and I know I'm asking you a lot of questions, but you have good answers. So you go, you don't understand, guys. Sometimes I just, you know, Reggie's very educated and I am not. So a lot of times I'm getting information from him just like you are. But so going back to a little bit more of the cultural thing. There are many, many different, well, I don't want to say sects because that's not really what I'm looking to say. There's many different divisions of the Christian church. Some of them are very literal when it comes to the Bible. Some of them are, they literally believe in an eye for an eye, right? Like they believe. Some of them take a more gentle line towards that, right? So there's these, and a lot of that is divided by the culture that that church exists in, right? Like if you, like I'll use my dad for an example. The culture of church that my dad exists in is very, it's, and I call it a country church. I've listened to some of the men that he know preach, and they are honest to goodness, just heartfelt men of God up there giving a good word and doing the best they can. You know, guys, you know, that work a full-time job and a part-time job and then still show up every Wednesday and Sunday and with a prepped sermon and ready to rock and roll. And I have a huge appreciation for those men. Those guys are far more organized in their biblical study than I am. So, but when you get into these cultures, you know, one of the things that I've always said, and one of the part of this whole thing where I just kind of separated away from denominations was the moment I was accepted as God's family, I don't really care if anybody else accepts me or not. I'm part of God's family. And if you love me, you want me to be in your church, great. If you don't, I can go find another one. But you'll have these churches where you'll have these really literal biblical followers, right? Like they're like gnashing of teeth and, you know, like the biblical follower. And then you'll have these churches where they're not quite as extreme in their belief. How in a coexistent style, how would those kinds of churches kind of exist with each other in a way as to not, you know, because if you're a new Christian, you're going to go try different churches, right? I know that Julie and I, when we started our church journey together, we probably went to probably 25 different churches in a 6-month period, just doing Wednesday nights and Sunday nights and kind of feeling out the culture and, and a lot of them we would go in and we'd be like, wow, they're kind of yikes. Like they're kind of hardcore. And then some of them we'd be like, oh, dude, the first thing they hit you with in the door was, can I get your annual income? Right. And then some of them were, you know, well, you know, if you were blah, 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 your kids are blah, a lot of different things. Right. So how do we reconcile and coexist with those things? Because a lot of those things, you know, can become very abrasive, and when lifestyles clash can cause tension between Christians. So how do we, if you were to kind of give me an idea of how to deal with that kind of culture, is to bring everyone together, because ideally it would be under the teachings, right? It would be under the church and under God, and we would all come together as believers and we would let all those things go and we would worship together and learn to coexist, but that doesn't always happen. So how do you think we would bridge that gap or start to bridge that gap in order to bring, to take away that division, so to speak?
But you're asking a question though, that no one has been able to answer.
Well, I know, but what I'm asking is if, in your opinion, if you were to try to cross that over and kind of bring those things together, what would be your approach?
Well,
Mine would be to literally remind them both. You're both Christians. You both believe in the word of God. You're allowing tradition to get in the way. You're picking up a dime and stepping over a dollar is what you're doing. You need to be aware of what's happening and remember what the Bible teaches you and come together as a family of faith and forget about all this garbage. But I know that that kind of doesn't always work. I'm a little bit more hard-edged when it comes to that stuff. I don't really have a lot of patience for that. what would be something that you would suggest might work or might be a good way to start?
This is where Christian scholarship is so important, and vital to anything we're doing, right? Because the gospel itself isn't difficult. I mean, it's really put together for any human to understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, you have a person who was born from a virgin birth that fulfilled the law, was sinless, died for you. You're going by his teachings. You follow him. Okay. So when we're talking about anything with unity between different sects or denominations or whatever the case may be, the first point is to solidify on who Jesus is. The very first thing is you have to establish and make sure that is the, if that's not the same, nothing else matters, right?
Yeah.
If you don't believe some part of Christ as a Godhead or not or whatever, that's a non-negotiable though in some between those two people.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you know, if you get to the point where you're like, okay, cool, the Christ, you agree on Jesus, then the rest of it becomes a study on what the text says, and is Scripture, and even before that, is Scripture sufficient? Is Scripture complete? Is the Scripture completely, you know, to be trusted? All that those questions have to be answered. You got to agree on that, because if you can't agree on that, then where are you going to with your information? Yeah. Right. So, and there's people that won't agree on these things. In the way we exist in this reality, we will not be completely unified, because there's too much, because we're all humans and we're corrupt. We don't have the right. We don't have.
Well, you know, funny, because I'm a huge Billy Graham fan. I think he was one of the wisest Christian men to ever be on this planet. And he said something in a sermon one time, and I went back and found it when I was reading about this, and I kind of laughed. He goes, I went, picked up a Bible at a Baptist church, and I went and picked up a Bible at a Presbyterian church. And he says, you know what the difference between those two Bibles were? Nothing. He goes, they both said the exact same thing. He goes, yet we have churches arguing over the faith and reading the exact same book.
Yeah.
And they can't come to agreement.
Right. Right.
And I'm like, but what a true statement, right? Like,
yeah.
If I go to my church or I go to the church across the street from me, they're reading this. It might be a different translation, but it's the same Bible, whether it's ESV or Old Testament or New Testament or, you know, New English or whatever you want to say it is, right? The Living Water version. There's so many versions. But Billy Graham, he goes, this is, you know, the difference is nothing. He goes, they're reading the same book, but how are they finding, how are they calling themselves true believers and finding their way to different things?
Again, there are some fundamental doctrinal principles that I would consider to be critical to being a Christ follower. If you don't hold to the biblical understanding of Jesus being both man and God, that he fulfilled the law from the Old Testament, he lived a sinless life, he was crucified for your sins as well as all of humanity, like all of humanity's sins, he was resurrected, he defeated death in the, you know, he rose again, he preached after that, the whole character of Christ, man. If that's not the same, if that's not doctrinally the Messiah, part of the triune God, the Trinity, if he's not the resurrected, is not living, existing today as a resurrected Christ, then there's nothing to do after that.
Now, take what you just said. All right. And now let's blow it up. Let's take it away from the Presbyterians and the Lutherans, and let's take it to the European church and the American church. Do you believe the exact same thing?
Yeah, that doesn't change.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. I mean, like, for all of this stuff, it doesn't matter if you're in Australia, if you're in Russia, if you're in the U.S. I mean, it's all it's the same.
Yeah.
Right? Jesus is the same. Now, your traditions and stuff that have told you I don't have any idea what those look like from that perspective, you know, but there's a lot of doctrinally sound churches everywhere who have the same idea, the same realization of who Christ is, though, right? All across the globe. Like, there's Christ followers exist everywhere, and they might use a different language, have different metaphors, whatever, but at the center point of all of those principles and like ideologies is the same version of who Christ is.
Okay, so now let's take it out and leave it a little further. And this is kind of where I was talking about earlier, but you've kind of given me like a more optical view of what I was asking. All right, so we know that I agree with you that the church has to agree on certain biblical principles. They have to agree that about the Trinity. They have to agree about everything in order to be unified. So let's take it out into a little bit wider orbit, right? Where this is where I'm really kind of have a deep interest, mainly because I told you somebody asked me a question, but I think I know a better way to ask this. Does God speak beyond the church? And what I mean by that is, you have the church, the building, the people, the traditional Christian church. And then you have people in the world that haven't necessarily heard the gospel, don't have a church to attend. Missionaries haven't made it there. We honestly don't know if it's within God's plan for them to make it there, right? Honestly, if you want to sit down and really kind of wind this out. So does God speak beyond the church into cultures that may not understand what our understanding of the Christian church is? Does that question make sense? Is there a way that I'm going to completely make this up? Let's say in northern, eastern, western Icelandia,
eastern, western,
where there's night 9.5 months out of the year, and they live in the dark, and nobody's ever been there, and there's no churches, and they all live in a hut. Does God speak?
The hut people.
Does God speak salvation beyond the church?
Would somebody who has never heard the gospel, who's never seen a Bible, who's never heard somebody speak about anything about Christianity, if they lay their whole entire lives without no exposure to the who Christ or anybody yeah. else, would they go to hell or heaven when they die?
Well, that's not the question I'm asking.
Well, but that's what you are, though, because
what I'm asking is God capable of saving someone beyond what the church will provide, right? Beyond the missionary field, I personally have a hard time thinking that if there's a place on earth where a missionary hasn't been, that God wouldn't provide an opportunity for some level of spiritual awakening for someone.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no correct answer here that's like solidified in any kind of like way, because for one,
oh no, I'm not looking for like,
I know, but you know, all you can look at is say that if God cannot be anything but have a perfect sense of morality, a perfect sense of justice.
Yeah.
There is no, if he doesn't have that, then everything else is null. Doesn't matter. Right. And he says he reveals creation, reveals the creator.
Yeah.
Right. So everywhere you look, it says, oh man, look, there's a, you know, there's somebody who created all this stuff. So what that tells me is that there's, I don't know what that could possibly be, but if somebody lived in some remote village of somewhere, have never heard anything.
You can say East Northwestern.
No, no, because that's
Icelandia.
Kind of weird. The Hutt people. But sure, there's probably a way of some sort that there's a something. I mean, I just don't know. I couldn't fathom what that would be.
Because I'll be honest with you, just in my experiences in life, God has spoken to me a whole lot less outside the church than he's ever spoken to me inside the church.
Okay.
So, and looking back in my life, recognizing the path that I've been on, I've realized he's been talking to me even when I didn't know who he was.
I mean, look, this is, you got to look at also too, how, what missionaries experience when they go out and do things. Yeah. I mean, they're approaching people who've never heard this stuff, and they have all kinds of, all kinds of different viewpoints of things. Some of them already have a name for their deity that they've done or whatever, right? I mean, there's all kinds of things. When you had the early church of, we're going back to like Abraham and stuff. I mean, like, look, there wasn't like some church building that they were going to and all this kind of stuff either. I mean, God was communicating to him, fulfilling his path to you know, saving humanity. All this stuff was going on. It's still that he's still going to do the same thing today with people.
Yeah.
So, you know, sure. I mean, maybe they don't have the, they don't say Yeshua, or they don't say Elohim or Jesus or whatever. I mean, they might have some other name for it. I don't know. It's hard to say, man, because you got, I would just say that when you look at those near death experiences, which we can get into at another time,
which I'm very much looking forward to doing an episode, cause you've got me starting to read those things, and there is some pretty amazing stuff that I've read.
Those things encounter, they encounter Jesus. I mean, even, even Indians and Hindus and Buddhists and all this stuff who's interviewed, they see that, you know, that. So to say that there's not some mechanism there, I think that's just foolish. I think there's got to be something there that fulfills that. But at the same token, man, it's God's call, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's again created everyone with a unique purpose to fulfill something or whatever, right? So, and every, you know, whatever choices that ends up being, whether that's a function that happens while they're on the earth or when they die, I don't know. I mean, but
well, it's interesting. My brother Tripp tells a story. He's a minister. And he was into drugs and had a lot of trouble and I might be butchering this, and Tripp will let me know if I am, but I believe the story goes, he was in jail and he said God woke him up out of a dead sleep and essentially told him, listen, you're screwed up, and you get on the right path. And ever since then, he's been preaching the word. He's got his own church now. He's doing very well. Kentucky Revival Hub. They're very, he's a very solid man in his walk with God. And I really truly believe that, I don't think you can deny the voice of God. I really don't, because it, and when I say the voice of God, I don't mean the audible voice of God. Have I ever heard God speak like audibly? No. Have I ever clearly understood what he's trying to tell me? Yeah, I have. The one time I can recall, I was having a really hard time. I was drugs, alcohol, all that garbage. And I was laying in bed one morning, and I say I heard it. I can't explain exactly how to translate it. But it was just, you're done. This is over for you. No more. And from that day forward, I just went, you know what, I'm done. And it was very much a very clear and definitive message. Did I hear God like roll up and be like, Brian, thou art done? No, I didn't hear that. But he definitely sent the message like loud and clear, Brian, you're done. No more. And I didn't do anything from that day forward. Right? Like, so I think that he can speak to anybody, anywhere, at any time. Now, will I say that you'll recognize him and go, oh God? But I think there's this part of us that yearns to be in touch with that spiritual leader, that spiritual creator that we have. I mean, some call it the God-shaped hole, you know? So I believe that God can use anybody in any circumstance, anywhere.
Yes.
Period. So do I believe that God can evangelize and touch people and transform people and save people beyond the church? I absolutely do. Now, what does that look like? Man, that's, well, how would you and I ever know that? Right.
No, like, but we wouldn't. But think about it this way. Okay. God is still sovereign over the universe.
Yeah.
Okay. That hasn't changed. That's still the same way as it was before creation.
Sub question. Can God save UFOs? Just kidding. Never mind.
UFOs is defined by unidentified flying objects that are most likely spiritual beings that we have not been able to qualify.
All right. Sweet. Look at you, Red. See, look at the educated man over here just whipping out the answers.
That's truly what I think any of this UFO crap is. They're just freaking angels or demons. You know, more like demonic stuff. Yes.
You know, I have a question too. This is kind of I want a rabbit trail. Hold on,
let me get back to this. You're going down all these rabbit trails, but I got to finish.
I'm sorry, I got tons of rabbit trails.
So look, the thing is, God's still sovereign, and he knows what he gives you the free will to choose, but he already knows what you're going to choose. His function of this whole wild ride we're on here on earth is like all already seen and done. And I mean, it's run its course. He's already seen the beginning and the end, yeah. Right? We're in the middle somewhere. Okay. He's the only one who has the right to say who lives, dies, who does what and whatever. We have a choice. And I mean, like, you know, he just knows what we're going to pick. In other words, we have agency in our own lives, but he already knows that. But he is also the sovereign of the entire universe. He has created every single thing that exists today, right? Yeah. So whatever happens is according to his will. Sure. So whatever you can only, and if it doesn't function that way, then there's no point. What are you really following at that point, right? What deity are you really looking at? Because that's just a shallow, superficial being that you're just elevating to some lower G God person. No, it's God big G for a reason, right?
Yeah.
So whatever tribe or hut people or person
hut people. I'm starting to like hut people.
I know.
Hut people.
Some, you know, whatever. I mean, he's created these people. He knows he's given them a path and choices to make. He knows what choices they're going to make. His plan will be fulfilled no matter what.
Yeah.
And looking at it farther than this existence we have on this earth, because this is but a blink of the existence that occurs after we die.
Yeah.
Right. So when we go on from this existence, we go into the real stuff. And that's what, I mean, that's what I'll just say, right? No matter what, he's got it all worked out.
Okay. So here's where, and this also leads to the biggest struggle that I have kind of when I'm discussing my faith with someone and they're asking me about me as a follower, right? Because I'll say it, I'm a slave to Christ. I'm a willing slave. I'll do whatever.
Bond right? servant.
I'm a willing slave to Christ.
As Paul said.
It's okay. But then we get into, well, If you're going to die because you don't follow him, then you don't really have free will. If you're going to be eternally damned for making your own choices, you don't really have free will, because you're being told that if you don't do it his way, you're going to be punished.
Not really. I wouldn't put it that way.
Well, but that's how they put it, right? When the argument happens. And I think that ties into a lot of this, is the difficulty, because you have what I like to call happy churches, where we don't talk about the bad, we don't talk about the bad stuff. We don't want to take it back.
Why would you want to exist in a realm with a God that you never wanted to believe in the first place?
But that's their argument. And I found this out the hard way, because I had to dig until I got someone to say it. They're like, I didn't choose to come here, so I'm not choosing to exist in any realm with or without any God. I was brought here without being asked. That's the stupidest argument on the planet. But, and so how is it that I'm having to choose to follow a God who brought me here and I didn't ask him to? And I'm like, well, first of all, that's just dumb. That's just a childish, that it's actually a really childish argument, right? Like, but that's where the argument always goes, right? Like, it always goes, well, nobody asked me. Well, you were an infant. Nobody was going to ask you, dude. What were you going to do?
It's like, not just that, though.
I don't feel like being here, so thank you.
You didn't exist. Like, you literally did not. You were nothing. You weren't. So how could you do any agency of anything if you don't exist, right? He creates you.
Yeah.
Puts you in on earth. You should be thankful that you exist at all to even think such a stupid thing.
Yeah.
The second part of that, it's even beyond me. Why should I follow? Okay. If you were created and there's a God, there's a lot of to say there, wouldn't you want to know how he kind of has things orchestrated and maybe like what he wants out of you and all that stuff?
I think that's our human side, man.
You know,
we want our way. We want it, right?
Well, no, but so, and it's hubris to not think that. What I'm saying, like, if you think that because all that is idolatry. You're trying to elevate your agency over his.
Yeah,
it's ego to the.
Well, I always tell them this: if they're looking for a, because most of the time it's a non common sense argument anyway.
It,
right?
it doesn't.
But what I'll say is, I always go back to the thing that my grandmother always used to say to me. She used to say, Brian, if you live your whole life as a good person and you believe in God, and because you believe in God, you treat people well and you do good things and you worship and you believe in a higher power than yourself and you die and there is no God, she goes, you still lived a really good life. She goes, so where's the bad in believing?
Right? I know, but they're going to toss that out and just say like, yeah, but then why would I choose something and follow all this stuff because that's not what I want to do and that doesn't make me happy.
But that's this generation, right? Like, that's not our generation. When my grandmother said that, yes, that made sense.
I've heard the same thing, but today though, this is where it becomes like some. They're supplanting God's authority with their own.
Yeah.
That's all that's what it boils down to.
Or trying to support authority entirely, which is to say trying to abort and support responsibility.
It's a usurpation, right? It's the same thing that Adam and Eve did when they were in the garden. We are usurpers in every sense of the word, because they're assuming that their way is the right way. Yet they don't take the time to understand how there could be the other, like, what's the way God's talking about? And like, why, if truly there is a creator, then yes, there is objective reality behind everything. How can you even define right way when you don't have any objective morality or truth behind what that right is?
I go back to what Ben Shapiro said. if everything's right and everything's wrong,
there's nothing right or wrong.
There is nothing.
No, there's nothing. There's nothing. C.S. Lewis, so, Mere Christianity. Just read it. But yeah, I mean, that's the, it's just, it's so look, either you believe everything came from nothing
or everything came from God.
Like nothing led into everything spontaneously without anything. And
the thing that I would argue with that when you say that is you cannot argue against intelligent design. Just look at everything.
Well, it's not, I mean, look,
this the order does not suborn from chaos.
Well, you know, I don't want to get too deep into that because that's a deeper subject that we can get into in another time. But and most likely be like a multi-part thing about that. So in general, look. We have a diverse group of beings that we call human that exist for unique purposes that can be exposed to God and the gospel in the most objectively truth manner. There is only one triune God, Jesus, Holy Spirit, and our whole quest is to better understand and know what that is and how we can be a part of it. We are all have agency to do so.
Can I make a confession?
Sure.
I've stopped trying to understand him and I've just submitted. Let me explain what I mean by that. I'm always going to want to know more about God and read my Bible and study and read books and do all those things. But as far as me attempting to understand God's purpose for me, I've surrendered. God, I no longer want to control what's around me. I want you to lead me where you need me to go.
Well,
I don't. Okay, I have zero desire to impose my own will.
Okay, let me put it my way. I ask God every single day, put me where you want me to be. Help me say what I need, what you want me to say. Help me do what you want me to do.
Well, yeah, lead me, man. I'll go, you know.
I'd love to have some insight into what I'm doing and why. That would be great, but I don't need it.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I had this discussion with a guy I go to the gym with, and he's a quote-unquote Christian. I've heard him say some things that kind of tell me otherwise. But he goes, you would try to impose your will when you're here. And I was like, what do you mean? And he goes, well, you come in here and you work out because you want to look good. I said, no. I said, let me be clear. And if I've never said this before, I'm going to say it now. I believe it is the pinnacle of our responsibility as men of God to take care of and maintenance the first temple we were given to worship, which is our bodies. Now we're all built differently and we all do different things, right? But I use this as an example. If Christ showed up right here, right now, and said, Reggie, I'm going to give you a brand new church. I'm going to give you, it's going to be the most beautiful church, beautiful stained glass windows. Every time you step into it, you're going to be in awe. You're going to hear angels, choirs of angels sing. Every beautiful thing that you could imagine happens inside of a church is going to happen. Would you spray paint the walls and never take care of it and break everything in it? Or would you attempt to maintain and take care of the temple that God gave you? It's the same thing with our body. The very first temple God gave us to worship was our body.
To an extent,
you know, when he said, I'm going to give you this body and I want you to use this body to work in the betterment of my church. Essentially what he gave you was your first temple to worship, to work, to labor in his stead. If you dump on it, if you fill it full of garbage, if you don't take care of it, you're defiling the temple that God gave you. And I believe that one of the main reasons I go to the gym is, and I had this kind of epiphany a long time ago where I said, you know what? God gives me the ability to be strong and be mobile and be a protector and a provider. But if I just crap on the very vessel that he gave me to do it with, how am I going to do it?
Well, I agree to most of that, I guess. I do think we exist in a culture that has unreal expectations of people's physique.
Oh yeah. I don't follow any of that garbage.
I know, but what I'm saying yeah. is though that people tend to be very physical first.
Yeah.
When they look at someone or something, right?
Well, that's the carnal side of us, right?
It is. And then, but you have no idea like what they've gone through, what they've done or dude, our DNA is not perfect.
No.
Like no one has a perfect.
It's been so foully diluted over time.
I mean, somebody might be blessed with that freaking, you know, physical, you know, gene that they can go to the gym like once a week and they look, you know,
yeah.
pretty damn good.
And they can be like a person like me who I go 4 or 5 days a week.
I mean, you know.
And I look average.
And plus, you know, how old you are, all this stuff matters. I mean, you just got to make an attempt. But I mean, I just. Trying to be healthy, because I think what you boil down to is like, because you just don't try to be a gluttonous buffoon.
Yeah.
Don't try to be lazy.
Yeah.
Try to eat healthy. Try to do things that are healthy. Yeah. Yeah. Try to be healthy so that you can just fulfill. Because I mean, like, look, your physical body is what is going to get you from wherever it is that God may have you go to.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're not a doing the what you can to keep that thing going,
yeah.
then you're going to lessen what you can do for his kingdom.
Yes. Agreed.
Right?
Agreed.
You might not look, you might have a six pack.
Everybody's a bodybuilder, right? Like no. I don't have a six pack. So no. I mean,
look, dude, I've been working out now for a year.
Yeah.
Almost a year. Not quite. And I mean, I'm still not.
I lost 90 pounds. I lost 90 stuff. Pounds, dude. It took me 6 years to lose 90 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, but it's like, you know, I'm trying not to eat junk. I'm trying to do. I mean, look, you do the best you can, but like, people just need to understand that the physical self, the way they look,
the physical self.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, anyway, Brian. I enjoyed being interviewed by you today.
Well, first of all right, so let me explain this real quick before we cut off. I have these moments with Reggie where wisdom begins to come forth from Reggie. And I want to dig, I want to mine for that wisdom.
Oh, Lord.
So that's when I take my interview stance. And I'm like, all right. And I lean back and I let Reggie, profundicate. Profundicate all of his knowledge onto me
Lord.
Me to absorb and become wiser. And that was today. Guys, you got to understand, I'm a pretty smart guy. I'm pretty intelligent dude. I do a lot of reading. I do a lot of studying. I feel like I'm very well caught up. Reggie's probably a lot smarter than I am. So I like to, he's kind of a source. And when he's putting all that good stuff out there, man, I want you guys to have it too. So I just start kind of pulling, man, just pulling. So yeah, I appreciate you letting me interview you today, man. That's pretty cool. I talked a little bit.
You did.
You know, talked a little bit.
Thank you all. And we look forward to the next one.
I know.
I don't think have we established which subject we're talking about next?
Not week? Yet. I'm going to let you pick this one. I picked the last couple. You need to get in there and punch low. Get something up there, man. Come on.
I know. I'm going to be tired next week. It's going to be cool.
Dude, we got to do Friday next week again.
Yeah, no, it's all right.
So, it's all right.
We're R&B Talks.
I'm Brian.
I'm Reggie.
Bye-bye.
See you later.